VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. With the United Nations Security Council meeting Monday to discuss threats to international peace and security, the U.S. is working to ramp up diplomatic pressure on Russia over Ukraine. AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield tells ABC's This Week the Russians will have to explain themselves to the Security Council, specifically the massing of Russian troops near Ukraine. She adds the Western allies are going to be prepared to listen, but won't be distracted by their propaganda. Russia's veto power and its ties to other Security Council nations, including China, make any formal action unlikely. Meanwhile, the head of Russia's Security Council, Nikolai Petrushev, is rejecting Western warnings of an invasion, calling it completely ridiculous, and adding Russia neither wants nor needs war. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Russia's foreign minister claimed NATO wants to pull Ukraine into the alliance amid escalating tensions over the organization's expansion and fears Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine. In comments on state television Sunday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also challenged NATO in a claim to be a purely defensive structure. Russia's massing of estimated 100,000 troops near the border with Ukraine has brought increasingly strong warnings from the West that Moscow intends to invade its neighbor. Russia, in turn, demands that NATO promise never to allow Ukraine to join the alliance and to stop the deployment of NATO weapons near Russian borders, as well as rolling back its forces from Eastern Europe. Again, Russia's foreign minister is claiming NATO wants to pull Ukraine into the alliance amid the escalating tensions over the expansion and fears Russia's preparing to invade the country. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. North Korea did in fact confirm on Monday it test launched an intermediate range ballistic missile capable of reaching the U.S. territory of Guam, the North's most significant weapon launch in years, as Washington plans to respond to demonstrate it's committed to its allies' security in the region. The official Korean Central News Agency said Sunday's test of the missile was aimed at selectively evaluating the missile being produced and deployed and verify its overall accuracy. It said a camera installed at the missile's warhead took an image of Earth from space, and the Academy of Defense Science confirmed the accuracy, security, and effectiveness of the operation of the weapon system. North Korea said the missile was launched toward the waters off its east coast and on a high angle to prevent it from overflying over other countries, but it didn't get any further details. The United Nations Secretary General says the world body has received credible allegations that more than 100 former members of the Afghan government, its security forces, and those who worked with international troops have been killed since the Taliban takeover of the country on August 15th. The Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in a report obtained Sunday by the Associated Press that more than two-thirds of the victims are alleged to result from extrajudicial killings committed by the Taliban or its affiliates. He says that this is despite the Taliban's announcement of general amnesties for those affiliated with the former government and U.S.-led coalition forces. Landslides and flooding caused by heavy rains killed at least 19 people in Brazil's most populous state Sunday, while high waters forced some 500,000 families from their homes over the weekend. Three people from the same family died when a landslide destroyed their home, according to the municipal government, while four other people were rescued by firemen. Four children died in Sao Paulo State, and the state government said four other people died in Franco de Rocha. Deaths also reported in other regions. The Cincinnati Bengals were the NFL's worst team 2 years ago. Now they're headed to the Super Bowl to play the Los Angeles Rams in the Rams' home stadium. Matching the biggest comeback in an AFC championship game, the Bengals rallied from an 18-point hole to stun Kansas City 27-24 in overtime Sunday for the first trip to the big game since the 1988 season. The rookie, Evan McPherson, made a 31-yard field goal to win it. Then the Rams overcame a 10-point second-half deficit and took the NFC crown with a 20-17 victory over San Francisco. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Monday, February 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chin Edwafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, more countries evacuate staff from Ukraine as fears of a Russia invasion loom.
I made clear, as President Biden did in his conversation with President Putin, that a diplomatic path to resolving this crisis, a crisis created by the unprovoked massing of Russian forces all around Ukraine.
Taliban and families of 9/11 victims condemn Biden administration's move to split $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets.
Desperate Afghans queue for free bread as the country's humanitarian crisis worsens since the Taliban takeover in August, when Western countries froze international aid and access to assets held abroad.
And UN and other aid agencies increase humanitarian operations in Myanmar. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. More countries joined the list of nations evacuating embassy staff and urging their citizens to leave Ukraine on Sunday, as Washington and its allies warned that the Russian military, which has 100,000 troops massed near Ukraine, could invade at any moment. Moscow has dismissed these warnings as, quote, hysteria, unquote. Israel said it was evacuating relatives of staff at its embassy in Kyiv, citing, quote, an aggravation of the situation, unquote, in an apparent reference to the crisis between Ukraine and Russia. Australia and New Zealand on Sunday became the latest countries to urge their citizens to leave as soon as possible, joining Britain, Japan, Latvia, Norway, and the Netherlands. Canada shut its embassy in Kyiv and relocated its diplomatic staff to a temporary office in Lviv, the western part of the country. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said despite rising tensions, a diplomatic path forward remains open.
I spoke by phone with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, where I raised our serious concerns that Moscow may be considering launching a military attack against Ukraine in the coming days. I made clear, as President Biden did in his conversation with President Putin, that a diplomatic path to resolving this crisis, a crisis created by the unprovoked massing of Russian forces all around Ukraine, that diplomatic path remains open. The way for Moscow to show that it wants to pursue that path is simple. It should de-escalate rather than escalate. And it should not only talk about seeking a diplomatic outcome, but actually work toward one. On our call, Foreign Minister Lavrov said that Russians are working on a response to the paper that we sent to Moscow more than 2 weeks ago, proposing concrete areas for discussion. It remains to be seen if they'll follow through on that, but if they do, we'll be ready to engage together with our allies and partners. I also underscored that if Moscow chooses the path of aggression and further invades Ukraine, the response from the United States and our allies will be swift, it will be united, it will be severe.
The Biden administration is urging Americans in Ukraine to leave the country within the next 24 to 48 hours, saying a major Russian invasion could come during the Beijing Winter Olympics. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said a Russian invasion would likely include aerial bombings and an assault on the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Russia is carrying out massive military drills with Belarus and diplomatic efforts to defuse the Ukraine-Russia border crisis appear to be failing. At Friday's White House briefing, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan called on Americans still in Ukraine to leave as soon as possible, definitely within the next 24 to 48 hours. Sullivan delivered a stark warning on what a Russian invasion would look like.
If a Russian attack on Ukraine proceeds, it is likely to begin with aerial bombing and missile attacks that could obviously kill civilians without regard to their nationality. A subsequent ground invasion would involve the onslaught of a massive force. With virtually no notice, communications to arrange a departure could be severed and commercial transit halted.
In an interview with NBC News, President Joe Biden had a similar warning.
Look, that's why what I've asked is American citizens should leave now. We're dealing with one of the largest armies in the world. This is a very different situation and things could go crazy quickly.
Amid the Russian escalation, Biden held a call Friday with the leaders of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Romania, Britain, NATO, the European Union, and the European Council to discuss the crisis. On a visit to Australia, Secretary of State Antony Blinken also warned that a Russian invasion could start at any time, also during the Beijing Winter Olympics. What Russian President Vladimir Putin appears to be mobilizing the Russian military for now would be much riskier than any of his past military actions, said Michael Kimmage of the German Marshall Fund in an interview with VOA.
What's shocking about the current situation, if the invasion really does come to pass, is that it would be large scale. And that means quite possibly large scale casualties for Russia, but as well, perhaps the siege of cities, you know, humanitarian disasters, atrocities, all of which would be very difficult to hide from the Russian population because it's very close by and has all kinds of family, sort of personal and local connections to Ukraine.
Russia has moved ships from around the world to take part in naval exercises in the Black Sea, further heightening tensions. As part of the drills, Moscow declared off-limits large swaths of international waters surrounding occupied Crimea and the Ukrainian city of Odessa. Russia says it has no plans to invade Ukraine, but that it will protect its security interests. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Ukraine's LGBT plus community is on high alert in the face of a potential Russian invasion. Under President Volodymyr Zelensky's government, they enjoy free speech and assembly protections, but fear discrimination if Ukraine falls under Moscow's authority. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
In contrast to Soviet times, pride marches have been held in Ukraine since 2015. Police escorts are present, thanks to President Volodymyr Zelensky's government, which backs free speech and assembly for the LGBT plus community. But the threat of a Russian invasion endangers that progress, says Freedom House. Carissa Jackson is the organization's senior program officer on the Dignity for All Emergency Assistance Program.
Russia is one of the most repressive countries in the Eurasia region when it comes to LGBT plus rights. Legal persecution, intimidation, kidnapping, murders, even, and other threats. Further Russian occupation of Ukraine could be devastating for these communities.
LGBT plus activists in Kyiv don't plan to remain idle. Timur Levchuk is the executive director of the NGO Fulcrum.
Many LGBT people and me want to join territorial defense. It's a group of people who are ready to protect our country, but these people are not military.
Even if war is averted, freedoms for the LGBT plus in Ukraine are limited, says activist Olena Shevchenko. She says tensions with Russia have overshadowed the LGBT push for equality, an uphill battle in Ukraine's parliament.
We are struggling to receive the anti-discrimination laws, hate crime laws, and then, of course, the marriage equality. Last year, for instance, that's more than 52 documented cases about the hate crimes towards LGBTQI people.
While denouncing discrimination, Sviatoslav Yurash, who co-chairs the Values Dignity Family group in Ukraine's parliament, has reservations about laws against hate crime.
I see the extremes of introducing so-called hate crime legislation and the result of that. And that is something that infringes fundamentally on both freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of conscience, freedom of association. And that is not something I want to see.
The power of religious groups can't be underestimated, especially when it comes to legalizing same-sex marriage.
Churches basically will be the instructor for this debate, because they are very much the progenitors of the idea of institution of marriage.
During a vigil in Washington, Ukrainian Catholic Church representatives said there is room for dialogue on LGBT rights if there is peace in Ukraine.
We need Putin to stop his aggression and withdraw his 100,000 troops from in front of Ukraine so that the country can evolve and develop. Without that peace, there's no possibility of anybody to develop any real discourse.
Rachel Ivanchuk identifies as a transgender female and has distant relatives in Ukraine. She hopes peace will prevail and encourages Ukraine's LGBT plus community to keep fighting.
Even here in America, there are so many state legislatures that are either resisting or trying to roll back rights that have been granted to the LGBT community. And it's just important to keep an eye on what is going on and to keep pressuring legislators and government.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
The Taliban and families of 9/11 victims are condemning the Biden administration's move to split $7 billion in frozen assets from Afghan Central Bank and reserve half the amount while U.S. courts consider claims for compensation by families of victims of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this report.
Desperate Afghans queue for free bread as the country's humanitarian crisis worsened since the Taliban takeover in August, when Western countries froze international aid and access to assets held abroad.
Our situation has been bad like this for almost 1 or 2 years. Before this, I used to find some bread and water.
On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order allowing half of the $7 billion in frozen assets from Afghanistan's central bank to be set aside in a trust fund slated for humanitarian assistance in the country. The rest, $3.5 billion, is held back while U.S. courts consider claims for financial compensation by families of the 9/11 victims. The Taliban, which was in control of Afghanistan at the time of the 2001 attacks, refused to hand over Osama bin Laden, the attack's mastermind. A senior administration official told VOA that a judge had ordered those funds frozen in place so the claimants could have their case heard. Jacob Kurtzer, director of the Humanitarian Agenda at the Center for Strategic and International Studies via Skype.
These are the reserves of the Afghan people. They're not the reserves of the Taliban. And so freezing them and starting to divvy them up based on our own internal calculations, I think, sends the wrong message to the people of Afghanistan about what role the United States is playing in terms of responding to the humanitarian and really to the economic crisis that they're experiencing.
The Taliban also criticized the move. Spokesperson Mohammad Naeem tweeted that stealing the Afghan people's money that was frozen by the United States is the lowest a country could stoop to morally and humanly. The Taliban have taken Afghanistan by force and have no right to speak about morality, said Hussein Haqqani, director of South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute via Skype.
They are trying to get money to which they have no rightful claim anyway. This money was accumulated under the Afghan Republic, which the Taliban constantly fought. The Taliban never liked the idea of international assistance coming to Afghanistan under the Republic. So it is rather ingenuous of them to try and now say that, hey, this is the money of the Afghan people.
Many 9/11 families support distributing the frozen assets to help the Afghan people, said Brett Eagleson, son of a 9/11 victim. But he said leaving the distribution of the fund for 9/11 to the court will force the families to fight another that is wrong, unfair, and unjust. It is still unclear how the Biden administration plans to distribute the $3.5 billion for humanitarian needs in Afghanistan. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
6 months after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, American lawmakers have few good options for assisting the struggling Afghan economy without enabling the Taliban government. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports.
Afghans are struggling through the first winter of Taliban rule in 20 years. Taxi driver Baram Ali.
Let's hope that situation gets better for the people who are already suffering from poverty and hunger. If the Taliban government could cooperate with the international community and the world, we will have a good future. If not, God knows what will happen.
According to the World Food Program, only 2% of Afghans will have enough to eat this winter. And the United Nations has put out an emergency call for $4.4 billion in aid to stave off a looming humanitarian crisis. Non-governmental organizations say the cause of the crisis is clear. International Rescue Committee CEO David Miliband.
Afghanistan is a starving country, not just a poor country. The reason, I'm very sorry to report, the proximate cause of this starvation crisis is the international economic policy, which has been adopted since August and which has cut off financial flows, not just to the public sector, but in the private sector in Afghanistan as well.
After the Taliban took control of the country in August, Washington froze $9.4 billion in currency reserves, leaving U.S. lawmakers with few good options for assisting the Afghan people without benefiting the Taliban government. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy.
There is, frankly, moral hazard
in putting billions into Afghanistan right now. We can do our best to root it around the Taliban, but there is no doubt that the partial effect of aid is to save the Taliban from itself. That is deeply distasteful.
Aid experts told lawmakers unfreezing private assets and freeing up money in the Afghan Reconstruction Fund could provide some direct relief to Afghans. International Crisis Group's Graham Smith.
Unfortunately, many of these steps require cooperation with the Taliban. That is hard and it is distasteful, especially as the Taliban continue to flout human rights standards. Months of talks between the Taliban and Western officials have not resulted in much progress. And the impasse is partly the Taliban's fault. They have resisted reasonable demands.
U.S. lawmakers know the costs of failure are high. Republican Senator Todd Young.
We, of course, must continue to be vigilant in our efforts to deny the Taliban any resources, financial or otherwise, that can use to conduct further acts of terror. The worst case scenario of all would be if humanitarian aid were diverted from legitimate recipients towards the Taliban and its partners in terror.
But in Kabul, Afghans are hoping negotiations with the Taliban will have a positive impact on the economy. University student Saeed Bakir Mirzai.
I want them to engage with the international community. Now they are under economic sanctions. They should establish a joint government with all ethnic groups included to have a true Afghan government so all sides see themselves in it.
Kabul resident Kari Omid Husseini.
I want the Islamic Emirate to use the foreign aid to build factories so that people can earn a living through their own work.
Last month, the Biden administration pledged to donate an additional $308 million in humanitarian aid to address the crisis. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is flying to Ukraine and Russia this week in an effort to help defuse escalating tensions, as Western intelligence officers warn that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is increasingly imminent. Scholz has repeatedly said that Moscow would pay, quote, a high price, unquote, in the event of an attack, but his government's refusal to supply lethal weapons to Ukraine or to spell out what sanctions it will support against Russia has drawn criticism abroad and at home and raised questions about Berlin's resolve in standing up to Russia. Experts say it is of utmost importance that Scholz stresses Germany is in sync with its European and American allies, especially when he meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. UN and other aid agencies are increasing humanitarian operations in Myanmar in response to a growing displacement crisis there. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The number of displaced people in Myanmar has doubled to more than 800,000 since the military junta seized power from the democratically elected government a year ago. The UN Refugee Agency says that number is likely to rise in the coming weeks and months as fighting and armed conflict intensify across the country. UNHCR spokesman Matthew Saltmarsh says his agency and others are increasing emergency aid in support of as many of the displaced as possible. He says they are living under precarious conditions and have pressing humanitarian needs.
Humanitarian access in many parts of Myanmar remains restricted due to insecurity, roadblocks, and challenges in obtaining access approvals. As a result, host communities and local responders continue to play a leading role in assisting displaced populations, demonstrating solidarity with each other by donating what they can.
UNHCR says hostility toward the military has grown since the coup and violence is spreading across the country. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warns Myanmar is heading toward civil war and the escalating conflict is threatening regional stability. The UNHCR has somewhat fluid, ambiguous relationship with the country's post-coup leader, Min Aung Hlaing. Saltmarsh stresses the need for organizations to have access to get aid into the country and to ensure that humanitarian staff can work freely. That access comes and goes, he says. For example, agencies have only been able to reach some 600,000 stateless Rohingya Muslims in Rakhine State sporadically. He adds development projects for their benefit have been relatively rare.
Life there is extremely difficult. The questions about pathways to citizenship still remain. This is a stateless population. As of course you all know, there's almost a million Rohingya who fled several years ago across the border to Bangladesh, and the situation on the ground in Rakhine State remains extremely challenging.
Some 200 UNHCR staff work in 10 locations across Myanmar. Saltmarsh says the agency remains committed to providing humanitarian assistance despite the difficulties. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Iraq, Muqtada al-Sadr, the biggest winner of the Iraqi parliamentary elections, reiterated his call for a government of national unity. This after meeting Ismail Khani, head of Iran's powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force. His view of the government is what he said would be, quote, neither Eastern nor Western, unquote. But the idea of an Iraqi government devoid of Iran's Shiite allies wouldn't sit well in Tehran, and other prospects risk a backlash from pro-Iranian groups, many of whom are heavily armed. Reporter Angie Omar discussed the political situation in Iraq with Ambassador James Jeffrey, chair of the Middle East program at Wilson Center.
First of all, it is nothing new. In fact, it's a step forward, because at other times I've seen the supreme leader in Tehran summon the winners of Iraqi elections to tell them what they should do. So this time the Quds Force leader, Ghani, went to Baghdad at least. So it's a step forward in terms of Iraqi independence. But it's clear that Ghani, from what we can tell from Muqtada's statement, has not persuaded Muqtada that he should basically submerge his movement inside a broader Shia movement, which will include pro-Iranian elements and will be beholden to the Iranians. So far, I believe that al-Sadr and his movement will try to come up with a what we call a majority government that will have elements of all parts of Iraq, but will probably not be heavily weighed towards pro-Iranian elements. And that is for the future of Iraq and for its relations with the Arab world and with the United States and Europe very good.
Experts believe that the idea of an Iraqi government devoid of Iran's Shiite allies won't sit well in Tehran, and those prospects risk a backlash from pro-Iran groups, many of whom are heavily armed. Is that a potential response?
It is, and the thing we worry about most in Iraq, we can sum up with, and it isn't even a code word, it is the Lebanon scenario, where you get a pro-Iranian element, in the case of Lebanon, Hezbollah, that has more power, not only political power, and to some degree economic power, but most importantly military power, than the rest of the country. That is not the case in Iraq. The Iraqi military is still quite strong, with elements that have shown their willingness to take on Shia pro-Iranian militias. It has Grand Ayatollah Sistani's movement, which is mainly religious, but he has his own militia, as does al-Sadr. And then, of course, you have the Kurdish north with their Peshmerga. So the situation is quite different in Iraq.
That's Ambassador James Jeffrey, chair of the Middle East program at Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He was speaking with reporter Angie Omar.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Ngoc in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is
is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.